So at the end of February, William Hamilton died. How many of you know of William Hamilton? He was the son of Mr. Hamilton. Yeah, good. Yeah. William Hamilton was a theology professor on the East Coast. And in 1966, Time magazine ran a cover about him. The cover of Time magazine in 1966 asked one large question based upon the teaching of Hamilton. And the question the Time magazine asked was this: is God dead? Well, I don't know about God, but William Hamilton sure is. William Hamilton was a theology professor that was teaching the death of God. What he meant by that was that God had always been nothing more than a concept, that God had never been anything more than an idea, that God had never been anything more than something that people thought about, a fiction to which they turned, a dream that they entertained in order to survive and in order to exist in this world. And so what Hamilton had taught was that God was dead, meaning that the concept of God was dead. The idea of the supernatural was dead. The idea that there was a divine being who was self-existent and who was all-powerful and authoritative, that idea of a divine being who was the creator and sustainer of all things, that idea was now dead. It was passé. It was something of the past. Strangely enough, what Hamilton taught in his classrooms and in his articles and in his books made its way down into the layers of the public so much that in 1966, Time magazine had to ask the question, is God dead? What Hamilton was arguing was that in order to live ethical and moral lives, in order to live lives of service to each other, in order to take care of each other, in order to be socially responsible, in order to do everything that is necessary for a good, stable society, you do not require the idea or the concept of a self-existent creator and sustainer. He wanted to hold on, you understand, to the ethical teaching of Jesus. And so to the day that he died, Hamilton called himself a Christian because he was a follower of the teachings of Christ, meaning the ethical teachings of Christ, the moral teachings of Christ. And what Hamilton was arguing is that you can continue to be Christian, you can continue to argue for the existence of the religion, Christianity, without having to believe in a self-existent creator and sustainer. Because Christianity is essentially a life of, well, well-behaved people, people who care about each other, people who are socially responsible, people who are ethical and moral, people who get together in order to uphold each other, people who gather together for meals and for, well, other self-help type of activities. Hamilton argued that in order to have an ethical, moral society based upon the ethical and moral teachings of Jesus, you did not need the idea or the concept of a self-existent creator and sustainer. And this idea caught hold not only in the United States, but also throughout the world, and it became known as radical theology and the death of God. Radical theology and the death of God. What it was a denial of the need of the supernatural in order to live life within a structured, productive, ethical, and moral society. Come with me to the 11th chapter of the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus is going to challenge this entire notion that you do not need the supernatural. That in order to understand him and to believe in him, in order to see him as he is, you do not need the supernatural. In Mark chapter 11, where we have been the last couple of weeks, we have seen that Jesus is confronting various groups, has had to come in and cleanse the temple. And so notice that after we get through all the stories of the cleansing of the temple and the triumphal entering and the withering of the fig tree, we come down to verse 27, where the religious leaders of Israel decide to question his authority. They arrived again in Jerusalem, and while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, I want you to see that you cannot keep the man out of the temple courts. He entered into the temple in verses 12 through 19, where he cleanses them, and he is back in the temple again. So they arrived again in Jerusalem, and while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders came to him. "By what authority are you doing these things?" they asked. "And who gave you authority to do this?" What they're concerned about here, of course, is the cleansing of the temple. He had just gone in and upset the entire status quo. The religious leaders of Israel had allowed the temple to become a place for monetary exchange, a place of commerce, a place of trade and of business, a place in which true and pure worship had become adulterated. They have allowed this, but he comes in, remember, as the new Jehu, and he cleanses the temple, getting rid of its impurity and of its misguided sense of existence. And so the leaders of Israel, the religious leaders of Israel, want to know, by what authority does he go into the temple, and by what authority does he cleanse the temple, and by what authority does he say the words that he says in verse 17, "My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." By what authority does he go into the temple, cleanse the temple, and start quoting the prophets as if he knows what they mean, as if he is able to use them authoritatively? By what basis, by what authority does he do all this? Jesus replied, "I will ask you one question," which is frequently the way I respond to my students. They ask a question, and my favorite response is simply to ask them a question in return, particularly when I don't know the answer. That's not Jesus' problem. "I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I am doing these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or from men? Tell me." Jesus asked the religious leaders of Israel one question. "I want to know what you think about the baptism of John. Remember that that's particularly the way in which the Gospel of Mark begins. Keep your finger right there in Mark chapter 11 and flip back to the first chapter of the Gospel of Mark. And I want you to see that the Gospel of Mark begins with John the Baptist. As a matter of fact, the gospel doesn't begin with Jesus. The good news that God is bringing into the world of salvation doesn't begin with Jesus. Notice, the beginning of the gospel, which is about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, begins with a prophecy from Isaiah the prophet. I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way, a voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight paths for him. And so John, verse 4, came baptizing. Notice, the gospel doesn't begin with Jesus. The gospel begins with John the Baptist. The gospel begins with God sending a forerunner, with God sending one to prepare the way for the one who is coming. And the one who prepares the way is signified primarily by being a baptizer, one who is baptizing people. And so Jesus takes them back to chapter 1. Let's go back to the beginning, he says. You want to know by what authority I do this or that? You want to know by what authority I cast out perverted use of the temple? You want to know by what authority I cleanse and restore true worship to Israel? Before I answer that question, I want you to answer me one. I want to take you back to the beginning. I want to take you back before me. I want to take you back to where it all started. And that's with my forerunner. That's with the one who came to prepare my way. I want to know, what do you think of him? It's one reason why I'm extremely proud to be a Baptist. I hold my Baptist heritage extremely proudly, because the gospel begins with a baptizer. Baptism has always been part of the gospel. And it begins with one who is preparing the way by baptism for the one who will come to baptize, one who himself will be baptized. And he wants the religious leaders of Israel to answer the question, was the coming of John the Baptist supernatural? Was it something that heaven arranged? Was it something designed by heaven? Was it something that broke the status quo of nature? Was it something that shattered the normal and the accepted? Was it something that rearranged everything that we have come to expect from nature? Or was it just a natural occurrence? Something that a human being could dream up. Something that a human being could dig up. Something that a human being could strategize about and produce. Was it simply a dance that a human being could choreograph? Was it simply a song that a human being could write the lyrics and the melody to? In other words, was the beginning of the gospel, which didn't begin with me, Jesus says, but with him, was this something supernatural, or was it natural? Can you have the gospel without an inbreaking into the natural order? Hamilton would say absolutely yes. You see, all Christianity is a bunch of people who get together in order to be socially responsible. It's a bunch of people who get together in order to treat each other nicely. It's a bunch of people who get together in order to sing songs together. It's a bunch of people who come together because they get an emotional lift out of the music that happens on Sunday morning. They get an intellectual or emotional lift out of an inspiring speaker. They get a lift out of coming together not only once a week, but sometimes twice a week. They get a lift out of being together. They enjoy and they feel good about helping the hungry. They feel good about helping those who are struggling with circumstances beyond their control. They feel better when they can help somebody build a house. They get a feeling of satisfaction when they do this or when they say that. Hamilton would say that Christianity, in its essence, is something which appeals to and can be produced by, choreographed by, completely, utterly natural means. And so Jesus wants to know, is that clock right or is that clock wrong? Because it's said 4 minutes after eight for the last 15 minutes, and so it's wrong. That's what Jesus wants to know. Is the baptism of John supernatural, something you can't produce yourself, or is it natural? This is a problem I face with my students. Because my students want to think that the life of a Christian, the life of a disciple, is the life of discipline. They think that if they're getting up early every morning at 5:30 to read the Bible and to pray, to sing hymns and to write in their journal, if they're going to church every Sunday and Wednesday meeting for a small group meeting, and if they're knocking on doors, that if they're doing all of these disciplined activities, that is the signification that those disciplined activities are the heart, that life of disciplined productivity and effort is the soul of Christianity. And they get so disappointed when I tell them and I remind them that if you let me go into inner city Dallas later on this morning and pick an 18-year-old boy who last night was participating in drive-by shootings, drug deals, and was acting as a pimp in trading and fostering the art of prostitution, if you let me take that 18-year-old boy to Paris Island for 13 weeks, 13 weeks later, he would have lost 10 to 20% of his body weight. He would have added that much in muscle weight. He would be more physically fit than he's ever been. He would be an expert shot with several different arms. He would talk a completely different way. He would say yes, sir, and no, sir. He would be getting up at 5 o'clock every morning, running 4 miles before he had breakfast. He would look great in a uniform. He would have been indoctrinated in the way of the United States Marine Corps, and he would be a utterly, completely different person than he was when I picked him up here this morning. But he would not be supernaturally changed. He would be a different person. He would look different. He would act different. He would conduct himself differently. But he would not be a different person. He would be the same person who had just put on a different set of habits, a different set of disciplines. And so Jesus wants to know, Do you believe that my forerunner was a natural occurrence, something that human beings could produce, or was my forerunner a supernatural occurrence that only God could have produced by invading the natural sphere? Jesus brings us down to the basic identity of Christianity. Christianity is not about strategy. Christianity is not about habits. Christianity is not in its essence about disciplines. Christianity in its essence is about a supernatural inbreaking of God into this world and into our lives. And so the question before the religious teachers of Israel, is it supernatural or is it natural? Is it from heaven or is it from man? Would you keep a finger there in Mark chapter 11 and come back with me to one of the passages that is quoted at the very beginning of the Gospel of Mark, Isaiah chapter 40. Would you come back with me to Isaiah chapter 40? Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all mankind together will see it, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. You know Isaiah 40 because it's the passage with which the Gospel of Mark begins, along with a small portion of Malachi chapter 3. You know it particularly from verses 3 and a little bit of the intention of verse 4. But I want you to see how the rest of the psalm, how the rest of the prophecy continues in order so that you can set what the gospel begins with from the context of this prophet. A voice says in verse 6, cry out, and I said, what shall I cry? All men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. What the prophet wants you to know here is that in the normal scheme of things, here's what happens. Grass dies and withers. And there isn't anything within the natural realm that is self-sustaining. There isn't anything within the realm of the earth that is self-sustaining and that can keep itself going. There's only one thing that is self-sustaining. There's only one thing that can keep itself going and that always returns the investment. And it comes in verse 8, the grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. Notice the contrast between the natural and the supernatural. Grass, flowers, natural. Enjoy them, mow them, water them. But they're natural. They don't last forever because they are not self-sustaining. The only thing that is self-sustaining is the word of God. Notice how the prophecy continues. You who bring good tidings to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good tidings to Jerusalem, lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up, do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and his arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. In other words, the one for whom the way is being prepared, verse 3, prepare the way of the Lord. The Lord for whom the way is being prepared by John the Baptist is none other than the sovereign Lord of verse 10, who is coming with power, and his arm will rule for him. In other words, when John the Baptist arrives, he doesn't arrive as the precursor of another human being who has just arisen out of the earth. He has come to prepare the way not for a king. He has come to prepare the way not for an emperor. Those are things the earth can produce. He hasn't come to prepare the way for a president, a mayor, or a governor. Those are things the earth can produce. He hasn't come to prepare the way for someone who is highly esteemed by humanity, has made his own way in the world, and has found a group of people that are impressed with him. Those are all things the earth can produce. The one that John the Baptist has come to prepare the way for is the sovereign Lord. Listen to how the prophet describes the sovereign Lord in verses 12 and following. This is the Lord who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens. He asks it in the form of a rhetorical question, but he's making a point. The Lord that I am introducing here, the Lord that John the Baptist prepares the way for, is the Lord who measures the waters in the hollows of his hand and measures the heavens with the span of his hand. You think my hands are big? The Lord's hands can take all of the waters of the seas and of the lakes and of the oceans, and they are barely a drop in the palm of his hand. The heavens merely are a fraction of a knuckle in the hand of the Lord. You see, that's something nature cannot produce. He is the maker and the sustainer of nature. Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? Who has understood the Spirit of the Lord or instructed him as his counselor? In other words, his wisdom and his knowledge exceeds everything that could possibly be imagined or contained by nature. We refer to this as God's infinite knowledge, as his omniscience. Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? And who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? He needs no teacher. He needs no instruction. Those are things that nature needs. Those of us who are participants of the earth, those of us who are participants in nature, we need teachers. We need instructors. Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Look at verse 18. To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? You see, when John the Baptist appears on the scene as the one who is preparing the path of the Lord, he is not preparing the path for a new king, a new emperor, a new president, a new governor, a new mayor. He is not preparing the way for something that has been brought into being by nature. He is preparing the path for the sovereign, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, omnibenevolent, and eternal God of the universe. And so his teaching and his baptism are a teaching and baptism which do not arise out of the earth, but they arrive out of the prophet. They arise out of heaven and out of the supernatural. And so when Jesus asks the Pharisees, the religious teachers of Israel, tell me, was John the Baptist from heaven or from men? Of course, the answer is from heaven. Notice how the discussion continues. Verse 31. They discussed it among themselves and said, if we say from heaven, he will ask, then why didn't you believe him? But if we say from men, they feared the people, for everyone held that John really was a prophet. They were wind testers, committed neither to the earth nor to heaven. The religious leaders of Israel were committed to the polls. They were committed to the results of surveys. They were committed to the results of interviews. They were not men who were committed either to heaven or to the earth. I can give Hamilton respect for this. He was a pure naturalist. He believed that there was no God, and so he acted and lived as if there was no God, taught and wrote as if there was no God. He was a man who was committed to the earth, and you would never find him committing himself to heaven. I can respect a man like that. But the religious leaders of Israel were wind testers. If the wind was blowing this way, they were people of the earth. If the wind was blowing that way, they were people of heaven. If the temperature was this, they were people of the supernatural. If the temperature was that, they were people of the natural. If the polls came back one way, they were peoples of heaven. If the polls came back another way, they were peoples of the earth. And so Jesus, seeing their utter and complete foolishness, and practicing what the Proverbs teaches, that you should not answer a fool, says this to their response in verse 33, we don't know. Jesus said, neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things. Christianity is at its heart the reality of the supernatural. We are men and women who are committed to the existence of a God who exists outside of time and space, a God who has invaded time and space by his miraculous goodness to us and by his wrath and judgment. We are a people who understand and who believe that there is a realm outside of the natural. And therefore, we are not wind testers. We approach everything in life with this presupposition. God exists, and he intervenes into the natural realm. God exists, and he intervenes into the natural realm. God exists, and he intervenes into the natural realm, and he has done it most wonderfully in the incarnation of his Son. We are not wind testers, which decide upon the characteristic of the moment whether we're going to go with nature or whether we're going to go with supernature. As Christians, we are supernaturalists, and our day ends and our day begins with this confession. God exists, and he intervenes into our natural world. And so, Father, I pray that by the Spirit who indwells us, that you would help us to approach all things in this world with the recognition that you exist, with the belief that you exist, and that you regularly intervene into our circumstances, and that you are always making your paths straight for the ministry of your Son. We ask it through the Son and by the Spirit. Amen.